Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
The Daytona 500 is NASCAR's biggest race. We know this. I talked about it last week with Chase Elliott. It's like starting the season with the Super Bowl. And then the Super Bowl was hit with heavy rain on Sunday, so the decision was made to postpone the rest of the race until Monday. Then Monday comes along, and it was all coming down to the final lap. Ryan Newman, Ryan Blaney, Denny Hamlin, all battling for the lead at the end of the race, and then this happened.
Ryan Newman off turn four for the final time. Blaney to the outside, to the inside. Here comes Hamlin up the outside.
Wow.
Crash into the wall, into the air goes Newman.
Upside down.
In a shower of sparks on his roof, Ryan Newman comes across the line fourth.
Fox on the call, and that is the stuff of absolute nightmares. Newman's car suddenly went to the right. It slammed into the wall. It flipped into the air, landed on its roof, and right in the path of Corey LaJoie, who smashed into Newman and flipped him into the air again, and then Newman's car caught on fire. I mean, it was so scary and so surreal. Like, if you saw that happen in a movie, you'd say it was way too much, way too Hollywood, way too over the top. Except that was all too real. Blaney had this to say afterwards.
You know, push Newman there to the lead, and then we got a push from the 11, and I made a move off four on Newman, and he blocked it, and I kind of went low, and he blocked that, so then I was committed to just pushing him to the win, and trying to have a Ford win it, and I don't know, we just got bumpers hooked up wrong and turned him. I hope he's all right.
LaJoie, whose car collided with Newman's, as the six fell back to earth, found out from a reporter that Newman was headed to the hospital.
They're taking him straight to the hospital.
Oh.
Yeah, so I don't...
What?
Yeah, so I didn't know.
I mean, obviously, I'm not...
Right.
Yeah, Corey LaJoie was in position to win the...
I mean, you can hear it in LaJoie's voice that how crazy and how chaotic that was. He was hoping that Newman would bounce off the fence to the left, and then he hit Newman, but didn't even know where he hit him. I mean, there was so much smoke and so much activity, and it was all happening at such a high rate and at such high speed that just before the finish of the most important race of the year, it was almost impossible to know exactly what was going on. And it's a reminder of the dangers that these drivers face. I mean, they make it look so easy, right? They make it look like it's all about positioning and strategy, but it's all happening at 200 miles per hour, and if one thing goes wrong, disaster can strike. Clint Boyer tweeted, quote, "This bleep is real. We're all on the road together, doing what we love. Please let Ryan Newman be okay here." I mean, the fact is, this bleep is real. And the good news, the amazing news is, Newman's team released a statement from last night. Quote, "Ryan Newman is being treated at Halifax Medical Center. He is in serious condition, but doctors have indicated his injuries are not life-threatening. We appreciate your thoughts and prayers and ask that you respect the privacy of Ryan and his family during this time. We appreciate your patience and cooperation. We will provide more information as it becomes available." End quote. It's the best news I've heard in quite some time because it looks so much worse. It looks so much worse. I don't want to understate the fact that he is in serious condition, but the fact that doctors have indicated that the injuries are not life-threatening is enormous, and it's absolutely incredible. Because when I saw that crash, and then I saw that fire, and I saw the reaction from everybody around, it seemed worse. It seemed much, much worse. I think we all feared the worst, especially when safety workers were holding up screens so people could not see Newman as he was being taken to the ambulance. The screens themselves were about as scary as the crash itself because of what they represent. Again, the fact that Newman's injuries are not life-threatening is such good news. It's great news. And in the midst of all this, Denny Hamlin wins his second straight Daytona 500 and his third overall, which is an amazing accomplishment that we should be celebrating today. But of course, everybody is thinking about Newman. Now, here's the other thing about that ending. And you can hear it in LaJoie and in the other drivers. Initially, they did not know how bad it was, which makes sense. If you're driving at the speeds that they were driving, there is so much going on, you can't see everything. It's not like watching at home where you see the crash and you know immediately how bad it is or how bad you think it is. This is why people who are taking a run at Hamlin and Joe Gibbs Racing for celebrating initially are missing the point altogether. I mean, yes, they were celebrating, but do you really think that Hamlin and JGR would be celebrating if they knew how bad that crash was? Of course not. I mean, it's an absurd take. When Hamlin and the team were celebrating, they were celebrating the fact that he had just become the first driver since 1995 to repeat as champion and one of only four who have ever done it. He was just celebrating the fact that he had won his third Daytona 500. Of course, it was surreal to see Hamlin and the team celebrating when everybody at home knew how extreme that crash was, except Hamlin and his team, of course, didn't know. As Hamlin tweeted, quote, "First and foremost, I want to give well wishes and prayers to Ryan Newman. I had absolutely no idea of the severity of the crash until I got to Victory Lane. There is very little communication after the finish, and I had already unhooked my radio. It's not anyone's fault." End quote. And then he included the praying emoji and Newman's nickname, Rocket. Joe Gibbs also weighed in. He said this.
When everything happened at the end of the race, I knew that there was a race, but I never even focused over there. I was focusing on our car, and everybody started celebrating around us. So I say to everybody out there, some people may have saw us and said, well, these guys are celebrating when there's a serious issue going on. So hopefully I apologize to everybody, but we really didn't know. We got in the winner's circle, and then that's when people told us later on the winner's circle. So I wanted to explain that to everyone. And it just makes it so hard. It's such a close-knit community. You know everybody. So anyway, I just wanted to say and state that for everybody. That's what took place for us.
So that's Joe Gibbs. And anybody who wants to criticize them really needs to dial that back because that's not what they're about. It was awful timing, but it was not malicious in the least. Congrats to Denny Hamlin. And obviously, I'm very relieved to hear the statement about Ryan Newman, and we'll wait and see. Denny Hamlin is my guest. Denny, it's nice to have you back. How are you?
Hey, doing good.
Good. Listen, there's a lot to talk about, and I want to get to your win and the history that you made last night, but everybody knows that Ryan Newman is in serious condition right now. He is expected to survive his injuries. I know that you did not know about the severity of that crash when you first crossed the line and you had unplugged from your radio. What was your reaction when you did hear about the crash?
Yeah, well, felt bad for one. I can tell you that. We went out there and I kind of just noticed it there in the grass, but it was well before I knew anything. So obviously, crashes happen all the time at the end of the Daytona 500 and a lot of races in general. But we definitely didn't know the severity of it until afterwards. So definitely still thinking about Ryan and his whole family. So that's our main concern. Still at this point.
Denny Hamlin, my guest, I was going to say to you, as a driver, you know how dangerous it can be, especially on that track. So when you hear that he is expected to survive, what kind of thoughts and feelings do you have? What's it like to hear that?
Yeah, I mean, it's great news, obviously, and things are, the news is getting encouraging, and that's a good thing, and we're just happy that, all the safety equipment and everything worked out the way that it should, and he kind of hit in the worst case possible scenario where you get turned upside down and then you get ran into kind of right into the roof. That's probably the most vulnerable spot of the car. So we're very fortunate and hopefully has a speedy recovery.
Denny Hamlin joining us. So obviously that life can be very complicated. It is very dangerous. This is playing out and we know this and you certainly want to acknowledge that. And so it's good news that he's going to recover and these are not life-threatening injuries. Now you become the first driver since 1995 to win back-to-back titles at Daytona. What does it mean to hear that and to make that history?
Yeah, I mean, it's special. I don't even know, how to put it in perspective at this point. I haven't had a lot of time to let it sink in. Being it just happened yesterday, but definitely look forward to the time where I can kind of relax and look at the highlights, think about, how it all went down and think about the great accomplishments that we had.
Denny Hamlin joining us. Now, that was the second closest race in Daytona history behind your win over Martin Truex Jr. back in 2016. So what was going through your head on that final lap?
Well, I mean, I was leading at the white flag and the problem with that, and you would think that that would be the place that you want to be, but We were the lone Toyota. There were seven Fords that were right behind me, and I knew they were going to kind of gang up on the back straightaway there. So they did. They passed me, and then I got hooked to the rear bumper of Brian Blaney, and I knew my best opportunity was to push him towards the lead and then let those guys fight it out. Hopefully I kind of picked up the pieces, and that's kind of the way it played out. We were able to make a great side draft there right at the line, kind of the slingshot pass, and one and a close one.
If staying on top of your budget and protecting your home are goals for this year, then you want to take a look at American Home Shield. American Home Shield gives you a plan when stuff breaks down in your home. I'm talking about the not so easy to fix, sometimes pretty expensive stuff, like your refrigerator, heating and air conditioning, plumbing and electrical. And believe me, when it happens, not if, but when it happens, you are really going to appreciate American Home Shield. To see all they cover and save $50, you want to go to ahs.com/Rome. That's ahs.com/Rome. If American Home Shield cannot repair the covered item, they'll replace it or offer an alternative solution. As the nation's largest provider, they have paid more in home warranty claims than any other company. That's added up to more than $2 billion in the last 5 years. America's most preferred home warranty, more than 1.8 million customers. Limitations and exclusions do apply. See plan for details. American Home Shield. Be sure with the shield. Denny Hamlin going back to back, three in the last 5 years, in fact. And Denny, I wonder, was there ever a point in time when you laid out the challenge in what you were dealing with yesterday, was there ever a point in time where you thought it's just not meant to be today, it's not going to happen? Or because you previously won such a close race there, did you believe you'd find a way deep down?
Well, I thought on when I took the white, I thought I got a great shot. 10 seconds later, I'm on the back stretch and they're motoring by me. I'm thinking, this is not good. I'm not going to win this. But as soon as I got latched on in turn three to Ryan Blaney's back bumper, I'm like, I'm going to send him somewhere. So we linked up. We pushed towards the lead, and I just barely had enough speed there right at the line to get him.
So, Denny, back-to-back titles for the first time in a long time, three in the last 5 years, as I mentioned. How do you explain the level of success that you have had in this race?
I can't. I mean, I keep thinking that we are defying odds. I mean, there's so many wrecks that happen in the Daytona 500, especially over the last 6 or 7 years. We just find ways to make it to the end with a shot to win. And we've been in this position now for, 3 or 4 years in a row, being contending for the race win. We won three of them. And it's been a heck of a run. I really can't explain other than, I feel like I'm a student of the game. There is a lot of skill that goes into, being a good super speedway or plate racer, as they call it, at Daytona. And it's just something that I've kind of latched onto.
Denny Hamlin joining us for a few more moments. I understand also that it's still sinking in, but when you make that point that you're a student of the game, like, how much have you grown as a driver, even in the last few years, as you've been dominating at Daytona?
All the time. I mean, they changed the rule package really this year from last year. It's a completely different, aerodynamic package. So, drafting is not just drafting. Like, you have to adapt your drafting style based off of how the car reacts. So, I go to work on it. I learn a lot. I feel like I keep a lot of good notes, and it's equal to success so far.
You're a student of the game. Now, Denny, what about the weather delay and the postponement? How did you and the team go about approaching that delay and the postponement from Sunday to Monday?
Well, I mean, it's a little bit difficult, but it's something that you can't control. So as an athlete, you got to be ready at all times. And we knew some weather was coming, and we had the entire next day to kind of prepare and get kind of stretched back out again, get refocused right around lunchtime to go back green yesterday at 4 o'clock. So it was a lot easier than kind of restarting in the morning, in my opinion, because we had some time to kind of prepare. But overall, delays are just part of what we do. It's one of the few sports that, when it does rain, it puts things at a pause.
I've got to ask you, because you're in it, it's probably tough to have a perspective, but that win gives you three, and the only other guys with at least three wins at Daytona are Jeff Gordon, Dale Jarrett, Bobby Allison, Cale Yarborough, and Richard Petty. I mean, absolute legends of the game. Has it sunk in yet that you're now a part of that group?
No. I still don't feel like I'm a part of that group. I mean, you're naming legends. You're naming Bird, Magic, Jordan. I mean, these guys are the best. And so I feel like I'm just kind of, you know, an odd name on that list, but you know, I definitely don't take it for granted everything that we've got done.
Now, your crew chief, Chris Gabehart, told you before the race started on Sunday that it had been 25 years that somebody had repeated since then. In fact, he said he talks all the time about how you can make history. It's just up to the team to go out and do it. How much does that ability to make history motivate you? Is that part of your approach?
It is. I mean, you know, my crew chief, Chris Gabehart, does an amazing job of keeping me motivated and putting the stats in front of me and saying, you know, here's what we can do. Let's go get it. You know, let's go to work and get it done. So I can appreciate someone that, you know, stays on me to keep that motivation. It's easy after 15 years of doing this to, you know, kind of take your foot off the gas, so to speak. But, you know, we've been full at it now, and he's definitely the guy that keeps me going.
All right, so yesterday was the big win. Today you're doing some media, handling some business, and then you got to quickly shift your mind from winning the Daytona 500 to focusing on coming out here, coming out west, and running at Las Vegas on Sunday. Have you thought about that yet, and what kind of transition do you have to make?
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be a quick transition. I mean, I've already got notes in my mailbox that, like, things I've got to, you know, start studying for this weekend's race. So, I mean, the work never stops for us. It's no different than, you know, being on an NFL team or any other baseball team. There's a game tomorrow, there's a game next week that you got to prepare for as soon as your event's done today. So we're going to enjoy it. I'm going to get back home this evening, try to enjoy it with family and try to unwind a little bit, and then it's off to work tomorrow.
Baseball can't look much worse. It's pretty laughable, isn't it, that anybody thought this might go away. The Astros are thinking, is this really a thing still? How long is this going to go on? I mean, that's comical, right? How long? Like, forever. It's always going to be there, especially given how badly you handled it when it first happened. And Rob Manfred's not helping matters either. Like, it's been more than a month since Major League Baseball announced the punishment for the Astros in that garbage can scandal. More than a month. How long does it feel to you? Does it feel like a short period of time or a long period of time? I'm guessing to Rob Manfred, it must feel like a lifetime. I'm guessing his hope would have been that that'd be a story for maybe a week and then maybe a day or two when camps opened up and then everybody would just move along. Except that's not the case. It has not been like that because we're 1 month in and it's as strong as ever. Stronger, in fact. In fact, as long as we're talking about Houston, let me quote a Houston legend. It's not only strong, it's strong as horseradish.
Strong as horseradish.
I mean, just how much venom is there? There's so much venom, and now it's being directed at the commissioner himself as much as the players involved. About the only player anywhere who said that he's had enough of talking about the Astros is Red Sox DH, J.D. Martinez.
I understand players' frustrations and stuff like that, but I think, my opinion, I think it's already getting a little bit too much. It's like we have to move past it at some point. You know, we just can't continue to talk about it. I know it's fresh right now. People want to talk about it, this and that, but it's 2020.
Look, I understand where Martinez is coming from on that. I kind of do understand that. I mean, my guess is he's pretty tired of being asked about the Astros, and a lot of guys are talking about a lot of mess publicly, about how angry they are, about all of it. He probably is getting a little weary of that. And at some point, there's probably going to be a guy who's talking a lot of junk about how much the Astros cheat, who's going to get busted himself for cheating, either for stealing signs or using PEDs or something else. I mean, mark that down. That's going to happen. Somebody who's making a lot of noise about all the cheating that they did is going to get busted too. However, back to Martinez. It is pretty interesting that a guy on a team being investigated for cheating is saying that we're talking too much about cheating. That's pretty rich, right? Of course, Martinez has been adamant that the Red Sox did not cheat in 2018, and he's expecting the investigation is going to prove that. Meantime, nobody is listening to him about moving on because there are lots of guys who are doing just the opposite. They're digging in to the batter's box, looking to tee off on the Astros or the commissioner or both. As an example, Angels superstar Mike Trout weighed in. First of all, before I get to what Trout said, just consider that phrase for a second. Angels superstar Mike Trout weighed in. Mike Trout does not weigh in on anything. Mike Trout shows up, mashes, robs home runs, smiles, and goes about his business. This is not the kind of guy to bump his gums ever, at all. He doesn't complain. He does not take shots at guys. He simply handles his job, and he keeps his mouth shut. My man is a first ballot Hall of Famer when it comes to staying to himself and staying in his shoes and not making any waves whatsoever. And even he could not wait to talk about the Astros.
Tough, you know, they cheated. You know, just I don't agree with the punishments. You know, the player's not, you know, getting anything. You know, there was a player-driven, you know, thing. You know, it sucks, too, because, you know, like you said, a guy's career has been affected. A lot of people, you know, lost jobs. It was tough. You know, it would be me going up to the plate knowing what's coming. It would be pretty fun up there.
Like, my man who never has anything to say about anything was going straight filibuster. Like, I thought they were going to bring up the Jaws music. Get this guy off the stage somehow. And it was awesome. I mean, if you didn't know how big this was before, now you know. Because Mike Trout is coming in hot. Mike Trout is coming in with takes. Mike Trout added, quote, "I lost some respect for some guys," end quote. The other key thing that he said was, quote, "it was a player-driven thing," which is another reason why so many players are so furious. Because the Manfred Report itself called it a player-driven thing. Yet none of the players were punished. How does that work? It was a player-driven scandal. The commissioner said so, yet the commissioner did not penalize or discipline any of the players. And the players were the ones who benefited from the scandal. Yet none of them got punished. A huge reason why people are so angry. A huge reason why so many of their peers are so angry. Because in their minds, justice was not served. And Mike Trout is far from the only guy talking. Yankees infielder Gleyber Torres has thoughts as well. Torres asks, how do we even know that the Astros weren't cheating last year as well? Quote, if you cheated in 2017 and won, why wouldn't you cheat the next year and the next year too? End quote. And he's got a theory and he's got an example to back up that theory. Quote, if I played video games with you and I see your controller, I'll know what's coming. I will hit really well and I will win. And if you tell me we're playing again, I'll do the same thing because I won. End quote. So why would he go with that? Because that's exactly what Torres does when he plays video games with Luis Severino. Quote, when I face Severino, I see the controller. The next time, I do the same thing. End quote. But it was not just about the Astros. Because the longer this thing is worn on, the more heat the commissioner has been taking. Like this from Mark Cuban, who tweeted out a video of Rob Manfred's interview with Carl Ravitch. And then Cuban added this note, quote, baseball is a mess right now, and they have zero vision to see them out of it. I'm thankful they didn't let me buy a team, end quote. Bam! Have some. I mean, it's one thing for somebody in another league to call baseball a mess with zero vision, but it's still another for Cuban to say, man, I'm really glad they didn't let me in. I'm glad they didn't let me buy a team. Because you know how badly he wanted to buy a team. You know how angry he was when they blocked him from buying a team. And I can't say he's wrong either about that being that big of a mess and the fact that there is no vision. Because we're 1 month into this, and it's showing no signs of stopping or even slowing down. This is consuming the entire sport right now. And because you have guys like Justin Turner directing their fire at the commissioner and his rationale for not stripping the Astros of their World Series title, there was this thought about the precedent that the commissioner created. Here's what he had to say.
Now anyone who goes forward and cheats to win a World Series, they can live with themselves knowing that, oh, it's okay. You know, it's just going to be, you know, we'll cheat in the World Series and bring the title back to L.A. And, you know, screw Dave Roberts and screw Andrew. Like, it's just those guys losing their job. Like, I still get to be called a champion the rest of my life. So the precedent was set by him yesterday in this case.
Damn, that's some serious fire right there. Serious fire. Straight fire, Alvin. Justin Turner was talking about how Rob Manfred said, hey, look, I'm a precedent guy, and it's got to be pretty bad for me to break precedent. And Turner's point is, oh, no, you set a precedent. You fired the GM, and you fired the manager, but you did nothing to the players. Therefore, as players, why wouldn't we cheat? It's only going to cost the manager and the GM their job. We don't give a damn about them. We still get to play. We still get to walk around acting like we're world champions. I mean, that is strong. But that wasn't even the spiciest stuff he had. Turner had even more. And it got personal. Personal to him and personal to the commissioner.
I don't know if the commissioner's ever won anything in his life. Maybe he hasn't. But the reason every guy is in this room, the reason every guy is, you know, working out all offseason and showing up to camp early and putting in all the time and effort is specifically for that trophy, which, by the way, is called the commissioner's trophy.
That is strong as hell. He starts off by saying, I don't know if the commissioner has ever won anything in life, but we're all here for that trophy, which, by the way, is called the commissioner's trophy. When was the last time you heard any athlete in any sport go that hard on the commissioner with that kind of fire? And he still wasn't done. He had another enormous shot that he wanted to land.
So for him to devalue it the way he did yesterday is just tells me how out of touch he is with the players in this game. And, you know, at this point, the only thing devaluing that trophy is that it says commissioner on it.
Hammered that point again. Turner climbing up onto the turnbuckle and then leveling Rob Manfred. Clearly, Turner did not appreciate Manfred, referring to that trophy as, quote, a piece of metal.
At this point, the only thing devaluing that trophy is that it says commissioner on it.
I mean, that's an all-time great line. One of the all-time great lines in any sport about any topic. The Astros didn't devalue the trophy. The commissioner did. By having his name on it. Like, having a cheating scandal is one thing. Having a cheating scandal where everybody is pissed at the cheaters and the commissioner for how he handled it is still another. You could see Mark Cuban. I mean, you might say that he's got an axe to grind because they wouldn't let him in, but he's absolutely right in saying that leadership has got no vision for working their way out of this. And if for some reason they do and we don't see it, now would be a pretty damn good time to show it. Because Mike Trout, if he's talking about how scummy you are, you're probably already at the point of no return. And people are mad, man. They're mad, and they're not turning the page. Jeff Ward is my guest. Jeff, it's good to have you on. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good, Jim. Thanks for having me.
Really good to have you. So you beat Anaheim last night 6-4 in a game where you fell behind 1-0 in the second. Then you tied it up. Then you fell behind 3-1 early in the third before scoring 5 straight goals. How pleased were you with the way your guys rallied in the third period and the response they gave you?
Oh, it was awesome, especially since we've been on a little bit of a losing streak at home. So when you get down 3-1, you often wonder if here we go again. The guys did not squeeze their sticks hard this time and came out and found a way to get 5 in the third and get the win.
I like that phrase. They did not squeeze their sticks hard this time. The thing is, though, that's the team's 7th win when trailing after 2 periods. So when you're in the thick of a playoff chase the way you are, could you make the argument, Jeff, that a win like that coming from behind does more than, hey, if you had just gone out and led the whole game? Do you get more out of a win like that?
Oh, absolutely. For sure. I mean, our team's been pretty resilient since the end of November, and we're starting to show that again during this playoff race. And, of course, this time of year, the game demands that you have that. And for us to come from behind in a game where we've been struggling a little bit at home, I think it does a lot for the confidence.
We're talking to Jeff Ward. You know, I want to talk to you more about your team in a minute, but you were named interim head coach back in November. And while everybody in coaching would like to become a head coach, that's not necessarily the way you want it to happen. It had been a difficult and emotional stretch for the team. So how did you prioritize things when you took over? What were you looking to do when you got there?
Well, first of all, it was a little bit easier for me with the transition because I'd been here for a year and a bit already.
Right.
So I already knew the players, knew the way that we played. So the biggest thing for us was just trying to, at that time, eliminate the noise from the outside and insulate the dressing room and allow the guys just to worry about playing hockey. And they did a great job looking after that. And I thought our leadership group was excellent. And we were able to run that into a 7-game winning streak.
You know, if we were to actually back that up, when you joined that staff in Calgary in 2018, you actually had a really good thing going in New Jersey. So how hard was it to leave there and then to go to Calgary?
It was a difficult decision because I did enjoy Jersey a lot, and we were building something at that point worthwhile. We'd gotten the playoffs. When the opportunity presented itself, I came out and met with Bill Peters, who was the coach at that point, and Brad Treliving, the general manager. And I really liked the things that they were saying. And, of course, it was an opportunity for me to get a bit of a promotion. I went back to New Jersey and talked to them about it. And at that point in time, they weren't prepared to do anything in terms of moving forward from an option year in my contract. So in talking with my family, we made the decision to make the move to Calgary. And it was a little bit of a rejuvenation for me going to the Western Conference after being in the East for 11 years. And my time here has been great.
Talking to Jeff Ward, I appreciate that response. Now, one of the things that comes from the front office, from the players, from other coaches, is your background as a teacher in Ontario. What were you like as a teacher, and how much did you enjoy that time?
I enjoyed it a lot. And I really got a lot of my coaching philosophy out of what I did as a teacher. That's the thing about athletics that really made a difference for me early and wanted me to become a coach, was just the commitment level of the learner in athletics is a little bit more committed than maybe you get in the classroom every day. And having the opportunity to work with people to make them better and realize potential was something that I really enjoy. And I've made sure I've carried that on in my coaching. I mean, the relationships for me are the most important thing, and how you work with the players on a daily basis, are it's so critical, and it's rewarding.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that because so many coaches do say that. So bottom line, how much of your job is about tactics and schemes, and how much of it is about what you just said, relationships?
Well, I think as a head coach, it's more with how you deal with people on an everyday basis. And the tactics and the things of that sort, the assistant coaches seem to take more of a load in that regard. With me, it's dealing with the players, dealing with the media, how to frame everything so that we're, you know, striving to get better on a daily basis. And that's really the majority of where I spend my time.
Calgary interim head coach Jeff Ward is my guest. You know, again, I'm trying to talk about your team, but I think your background is so interesting. For instance, when you were teaching, you started coaching the local midget team. How did that opportunity come about, and what do you remember about that experience?
Well, it was great. I was single at the time and teaching in a small town in northern Ontario. And I didn't really have anything to do after school to fill my time. So the local team was looking for a guy to coach, and they approached me with it. And being a guy who loved athletics and was teaching a lot of sports at the school, I figured I might as well do it after school as well to fill some time. And I really fell in love with the coaching and decided to pursue it.
So if I had told you when you started to coach a local midget team that you would eventually win a Stanley Cup as an assistant and then go on to become a head coach in the NHL, what would you have said back then?
Well, I would have said you're probably stretching things, but when you stick with things long enough and you give yourself to what your craft is and you enjoy it and have a passion for it, it's amazing where things will take you.
Jeff Ward joining us. I mentioned off the very top about the success you had coaching in Germany. What was that experience like?
Oh, it was great. I really recommend it for anybody. The game there is not as much of a grind because the schedule is less. You only play a couple of games a week, so you've got the opportunity to get away from the game a little bit. It's fun that way. You can spend more time doing other things. And I really like the professional development opportunity that it offered to me, and I would recommend it to anybody. Just coaching against other coaches from different countries, having the opportunity to go to world championships and being involved in that, it was really rounded me out as a coach and, of course, opened me up to a lot of new ideas.
And I said that I would ask you about your team before you left. So Andrew Mangiapane who was the one who tied the game at 1-1, got you back to 3-2 in the third period. Then he capped it off with a hat trick with the empty netter. When you've got a young player like that, and he works as hard as he does, and he earns the respect of the vets, and then he is rewarded with a hat trick, how good does that feel for you as the coach and for the rest of the team, the guys in the room?
Oh, it was awesome. I mean, all the guys were cheering for him, and there's no way last night that Johnny Gaudreau was going to fire that puck into the empty net, even though he could have. He was going to hang on and hang on until he had the opportunity to give it to Manji to get that hat trick. So when you're in the room and you love life as much as he does and you bring as much to the room as he does, and he's really earned the respect of our veteran players over the course of this season, everybody just felt great for him, and he's a real good story for our team.
And then finally, what do you make of the way he and Matthew Tkachuk and Michael Backlund and the way they all work together? How does that look and feel to you?
Oh, it's great. I think the thing that makes them so successful is that they're three real smart hockey players, and they have the ability offensively to hang on to pucks and create time and space for themselves, and so they're able to make real good plays when they see the opening.
He was a coach of the year in the AHL and in Germany. Won a Stanley Cup as an assistant with the Bruins. Calgary is just 2 points out of first in the Pacific, and they are in first in the wildcard slot. They're at home against Boston on Friday night. Jeff, I really appreciate it. Great to have you on the show.
Thanks very much. Love being with you.
So back in January, I brought up the topic of America's favorite backup quarterback. Now, you might argue that he's not a backup quarterback. He may start the year as a backup quarterback. He was a backup last year to start. Whatever. Semantics, right? Anyway, he made his first big swing, and he purchased a land yacht to drive across the 10 West to see the country that his brilliant mustache presides over. In case you missed it, I'm talking about Gardner Minshew. He announced that RV roadie early last month.
Hello, Gardner Minshew here. After a long rookie year, I've decided to take a step back, recenter myself the only way I know how. Hopping in my brand new RV and touring this great country. So if you're anywhere between Jacksonville and LA, I want to hear from you. Places to see, anything for free, food to eat, people to meet. Hopefully I see y'all out there on the road. But until then, keep it rolling.
That was an Instagram post from January, man. It sounded so good. Sounded so great. He buys himself a recreational tank and sets out to see this great land of ours, east to west. And all I asked, and I really don't ask very much of anybody, all I asked is that he document that trip, because this dude really does not document much of anything. In a social media world where everybody's documenting every last thing, the guy who's one of the most interesting guys of all is not doing that. His Instagram, despite its awesomeness, barely has a pulse. That road trip announcement post was his first in 7 weeks at that time. So I said it back in January. My man, I know it's a little bit out of character. Just roll some tape. Snap some pics. Let us in. Keep us posted. Share the experience with us. You're asking of us, where do I go? What do I do? Where are things free? Where's the good grub? Man, you got to return that favor. Share it with us. And of course, Gardner, Beowulf, Jockstrap King Minshew II did none of that. 14-day roadie, 3 picks. Look, I'm not even mad because I'm not even surprised. It says something about a guy who is too busy actually living life in the moment to slow down and set up a bunch of manufactured Instagram shots. Now, would I like to have seen that? Hell yeah. Everybody would have. But that phrase, pics or it didn't happen, does not apply to Gardner. Because you know it happened. I know it happened. Without even knowing, I know it happened. And you know that he was just too busy living to care about his phone or his likes or reposts. And I got to respect it. I don't like it, but I have to respect it. However, the caption to his last photo, which he did take at the Grand Canyon, laid out the trip from stop to stop. According to Minshew, the trip went from Jacksonville to Mississippi to Louisiana to Texas to New Mexico to Colorado to Flagstaff to Vegas to Joshua Tree to Newport Beach and back. Got to know where my man stopped in the 949. Had to have hit Javier's. Had to, right? That's a hell of a two-week roadie. And thanks to only having three picks, we know it included duck hunting in Texas, hiking in the Grand Canyon, and flying with the Thunderbirds in Vegas. My man went from the RV to the F-16. Remember in the announcement video, he did ask for suggestions on what to do on the road. The Thunderbirds saw that video. They invited him to Vegas to go airborne in their fighter jets. And, of course, he took them up on it. So Sunday, Lieutenant Colonel Kevin DeFalco was speaking at the Daytona 500 presser where the Thunderbirds were in town for pre-race flyovers. And he told the media, quote, "We were pretty excited that Gardner took us up on our offer. He did fantastic. He did really well. You could tell he was very motivated. Most of our maneuvers require high G-force pulls, and he did a great job. I was very impressed. I'd give him a 10 on a 1 to 10 scale. He was loving all the maneuvers. Some people get a little bit nervous, but he was not nervous at all." End quote. Man, that's extremely high praise. Really high praise. Put another way, Gardner, you can be his wingman anytime.
You can be my wingman anytime.
Gotta love that Gardner was, a topic at a Daytona 500 press conference with a fighter pilot. DeFalco also said, quote, "Sometimes people may not enjoy rolling maneuvers or high G maneuvers, so everything we do with these media flights is really for them. It's to showcase what we do in the F-16s. If they're uncomfortable, we would opt not to perform a certain maneuver." Gardner was excited. He just wanted more and more of every single maneuver, end quote. Of course he did, man. He's Gardner Flint. Some guys don't want that heat. This guy wanted the temperature turned all the way up. According to DeFalco, the F-16's G limit is 9.0. Gardner was in the bird, and he pulled the maximum, which is pretty awesome. If I were Nick Foles, man, I'd be nervous. Yeah, I mean, I know he's got a championship ring. I'd be really nervous. Because Foles has to beat that guy to keep a starting job in Jacksonville. Here's DeMinshew rolling into Duval with a Maverick jacket, some dog tags, an aviator, sunglasses, and having a locker room conversation about how dangerous it all is.
"You're everyone's problem. That's because every time you go up in the air, you're unsafe.
Gardner.
I don't like you because you're dangerous.
Gardner.
That's not nice, man. I am dangerous."
Gardner is dangerous. Nick. That's right, Nick Foles. He is dangerous. Nick Foles.
That's right. Nice, man. I am dangerous.
That's right, Nick Foles.
That's right.
I know you have a championship ring. We might not know as much about the Uncle Rico Rohde as we want to know, but we do know this. This guy literally took the highway in an RV, right to the danger zone. Wonder if I can crowbar one more reference into that. Hey, Gardner, your ego is writing checks that your body cannot cash.
Son, your ego is writing checks your body can't cash.
No, it's not. That's the problem. I wish it were. Gardner, man, come on. Document, my man. Document, document, document. Let us in. Where are the pics? Where's the video? That thing's over already. Nice shirt, Hawk. I didn't mean that. Hey, Rome. I will teach Gardner how to fly the bird. As long as he teaches me how to throw the tags. Regards, Maverick.
That's
As long as Maverick teaches him how to run. Now, my man runs high, doesn't he? He runs high, but when he goes to throw, he drops down. Three-quarter. Then again, that's the way he plays quarterback. Like Maverick. Ice cold. No mistakes.
The way he flies. Ice cold. No mistakes.
Ice cold. No mistakes. That's the way he throws those dog tags. Ice cold. No mistakes. Pretty athletic. But not as athletic as he was in that volleyball scene. That's the problem with, like, sports movies. I'm not saying that's a sports movie. The problem with sports movies, you've got actors that are not that athletic. Or you have athletes that can't act. We are joined by Caleb Wesson. Caleb, it's good to have you on the show. How are you?
Good. You?
Good, man. I'm great. I read your stats. You had a really big game in that win against Purdue where you were huge in all facets of the game. So let me start right there. That might have been some of your best defense all season long. What was your mindset, or what was the mindset of the entire team going into that game? And then how good did it feel to win the way you did?
Oh, it felt great. You know, all week we were preaching details and how detailed could we be. And I feel like me and our guys, we locked in really on the scouting report and the way they run their plays, and I feel we executed.
And you look at the season, it's a really challenging conference, obviously. If we were to go back, the team was number 5 in the country back in the middle of December, but then you dropped 4 straight and 6 of 7. At that point in the season, how would you describe where the team was, and what was your mindset then?
Then, you know, the confidence was down. You know, you lose a couple games, and guys start wondering where their roles are and how they affect the game, and I feel like we just got back to we were. You know, our coaches talked about roles and how we're going to execute, and you know, we really locked in. You know, we came back closer as a family and as a group, and that's like that really helped us.
In fact, that's what happened. The team turns it around. You win 5 of the last 6. So what was the biggest difference, other than communicating that to one another? What was the biggest difference on the floor in turning it around the way you have?
Just our confidence in everything we do, you know, even on defense, and our ability to guard one-on-one and guard your yards. You know, I feel like we got away from that, and that's what we pride ourselves on, is our defense.
Caleb Wesson joining us. Now, last season, when the season ended, you put your name into the draft, and you worked out with the Hawks and the Celtics. What was that experience like, and how did those workouts go for you?
It was a blessing. You know, the first one, I mean, it was kind of a struggle, you know, just getting used to that pace and that level of play at a high level like that. But I feel like in the Hawks one, I shot the ball pretty well. I was more confident, more comfortable in the situation and my environment, and I feel like I did pretty well.
You know, your process and your journey has been really interesting. Like you said, that when you arrived at school, you were in the neighborhood of 300 pounds with a 25% body fat. It's something you've been working on, but one of the things that the NBA workouts told you was you could play in the NBA, but they wanted to see you at a certain body mass index. What was it like to learn that, and then how'd you go about in responding to that information?
I took it to heart. You know, that's not really the first time I've heard that. I've heard that before in the USA camp, you know, the junior team. They told me that my skill level was there and that I was talented enough, but they didn't know how long I could play for that extended period at that level, you know. So hearing that from somewhere I really want to go as far as the NBA and the next level, that really hit my heart, and I feel like I focused in on that with all you, right? And even my off-campus trainers and IBT training.
I was going to say, excuse me for jumping in, but I want to give the listeners an idea what you did. You went to work now. You went to work on your diet.
Yeah.
You cut out juice. You cut out soda. You did extra workouts. The strength and conditioning staff talk about how much you love boxing workouts to the point where they sometimes don't like holding the pads because you hit so hard. What's that experience been like?
Oh, you know, it's fun. You know, my brother also got into it, which helps me having somebody in there with me to work and just being able to share experiences with. And I feel like that just even pushed me even more, seeing my brother wanting to be great just as much as I want to be.
I definitely want to talk to you about Andre. I'm going to talk to you about him in 1 minute. There is one famous story now, though, about a teammate who offered you a kale chip. What did you make of kale chips?
Oh, it was disgusting. No offense to anybody who eats them, but I don't know how they do it. I just not miss my palate.
They were disgusting. Caleb Wesson is joining us. Chris Holtmann, that's funny. He talked about a game Chris Holtmann did earlier this year where you played 36 minutes, and then after the game, you spent 40 minutes more on the rower. So with all this work you're putting in, how much of a difference are you noticing on the floor because of all that work?
Like I said, just being able to play at that high level for longer. You know, you'll see myself getting more rebounds, being more active on defense for longer periods of time, and I feel like it really helps our team, being able to stay on the floor without foul trouble and stuff like that, playing at that high level.
Now, you played your high school ball at Westerville South, and you grew up 20 minutes from Columbus. Your dad, Keith, played ball at Ohio State in the 80s. How huge was Ohio State and the Buckeyes in your house growing up?
Huge. That's my whole family's team is Ohio State. You know, a lot of my family went to Kent State, and everybody's kind of from that Ohio area. But, you know, just being able to play my at this university with all my family, being able to come to games and watch, not being that far away, it's a blessing.
Right, so, Andre, your brother also plays at Ohio State. But what did the two of you learn from your dad about basketball when you were growing up? And what kind of a ball player was he? Did you know?
Just the fundamentals. You know, my dad really wasn't the most skilled guy on the floor or scored the most points or anything. But, you know, he did his job at the highest level. You know, he played his role, and he taught us fundamentals and the things like setting good screens, passing, getting boxed out position. I feel like that really helped me and Andre as far as development goes.
Caleb Wesson, my guest for a few more moments. Now, your mom, Stephanie, says that you and Andre could not be more different. Like, how would you describe Andre, and how would you describe yourself? Are you two guys really that different?
Yeah, in a lot of aspects. You know, Andre's more of a quiet guy. He's not really going to say much, but he's going to show in his actions on the court, whereas me, I'm more of an upbeat guy. I'm talking all the time. I show a lot of emotion on the court, and I feel like that's what it is. You know, even growing up, you could see me and Andre were kind of different in the things we did. He was more of a into sports at a young age kind of guy. I was more into music and other things like that.
So when you guys were growing up, how hard did you guys go at each other on the court?
Oh, yeah, those were battles. One-on-one with no refs, those were battles right there, you know, arguing calls, just playing real aggressive. My mom and dad would have to tell us to come outside and calm down sometimes because we're yelling all throughout the street. The whole street can hear us yelling at each other. It was just crazy.
All right, so the story goes that Andre was being recruited heavily, but it wasn't by the biggest programs, and then he had that huge senior season, and then you have programs like Texas and Ohio State that are coming. You've said that you were telling him you could both play at Ohio State, that could work, but when it came time for National Signing Day, he was wearing a black jacket, and he would not tell you what shirt he had underneath. What do you remember about that day?
No, that day was crazy. You know, everybody's coming to me asking where he's going to go, and I'm answering, I don't know. And I was riding with him to school, trying to look at his shirt, trying to peep what he's trying to do, where he's going to go, but he kept it a complete secret for me and my family, you know. But, I mean, I think on Andre's decision, I feel like it was more of a family-oriented decision. You know, he realized that me and him going through this experience together, him being able to show me the ropes as far as how hard work goes and what it's like to be in college, I feel like that was something that went into his decision.
I mean, given your family background, given that you're from the area, given that he had a chance to play with you, I mean, that could not have gone any other way, right? Were you really concerned that he might go someplace else?
Yeah. Like I said, they came late. Ohio State came late, and that was one of the big things Andre was telling me is why he didn't want to go to Ohio State, because they didn't show him as much love early as the other programs did that were recruiting him. I agree with his decision as far as that goes. You know, you want to go where you feel like you'll be loved and appreciated, and you feel like this is the best place.
For sure. For sure. So finally, what's it mean then that he decided to end up playing there? You're playing with your brother at Ohio State. Is that pretty much like living the dream?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, this is a dream. You know, a lot of people don't be able to get the chance to do this, and us being able to, it's just surreal.
I have a beef with red wine because I'm super allergic to it. I also have a beef with whiners.
Like people who wine or people who drink wine?
Both. Kathy Lee can go bite my... This story is a non-story. It doesn't even deserve to be talked about. And then they cover the story and continue for 10 minutes or more, continuously saying, this is a non-story. We shouldn't even be talking about this, and continue on talking about it. What a waste. Don't bring it up if it's not worthy.
I'd just like to say that all those clones maybe that are calling in saying there's no big deal about the Astros and about how L.A. probably had sour grapes and all that. Well, in the words of Tony Soprano, I got your sour grapes right here. Anyway, that's my beef, Jim. This is Bob in L.A.
Romy, I got a beef with you, brother.
What's up?
You haven't mentioned Yoko Ono's birthday in the first full hour of your show, man. No drops, no nothing.
Good night now!